Chapter 13, ST, Dr. Jose Rizal Park, Seattle, Washington, USA. Word got back quickly. The ones with information about the one who opens doors were on their way to me. I was warned it would take them some time, which was fine, because I was absorbed by an unusual sight. Seattle spring has more moods than Tiffany S. from Tinder, and now the sun decided that it should shine brightly. Celebrating the sun, the murmuration of starlings were performing a synchronized dance, dazzling with a shape-shifting air show. The birds swooped and dove, carefree, oscillating and shimmery, the afternoon sun bouncing off their wings. Altogether, they formed a black cloud that morphed into a circle, then cinched in precisely at all the right places to render a Pringles tube, and then a twisty shape like a pretzel. They were one. A single entity. Expand, contract, breathe, dance, be. They were performing for an audience of one. A baby elephant. The young elephant, its skinny grass snake of a tail flicking high in excitement, limp trunk swinging to and fro, darted across 12th Avenue in front of me. He stomped excitedly with soft, flat feet that resembled young tree trunks. His fanned-out leather ear flaps, undulating, furless butt, and wide, shiny eyes were utterly delightful. The baby pachyderm, eager eyes to the sky, chased the wave of birds, buoyantly mimicking their dance, delighting in the way they painted the afternoon. Through the tree crowns, a cautionary trumpet sounded out in an unmistakably parental tone. Ma, or some other family member, was nearby, and I was glad. The game of chase went on, and part of me hoped it would never stop. I enjoyed the pleasantness of the moment, surprised to find myself giddy, as if full of beer bubbles that fizzed their way to freedom. A healthy, happy elephant calf. Turns out that's something that can fill up a heart. I'd read in the Seattle Times that the Woodland Park Zoo had phased out its elephant sanctuary, that zoos in general were doing so because of the difficulty in providing an enriching environment. Space was an issue, too. It was hard to provide enough of it for the healthy interaction of a whole herd. Yet, here was this little one, no longer facing the threat of having his tusks lopped off to make a letter opener or that his lasting legacy might be a photograph of a smiling mofo standing, rifle in hand, on his lifeless trophy. I imagine he had come all the way from Point Defiance Zoo and Aquarium in Tacoma, from miles and miles away. Now he had all the space of a whole new earth to dance around in. Gorilla, hippo, and now elephant, stamping Seattle soil with their prints. How had this come to be? This was a strange new realm with new rules that were hard to keep up with. I wished the little elephant well. Mofos revered elephants, and even in this little pipsqueak I could see why. They are large and charming, confident and curious, and apparently they never forget. Dennis! Dennis! I left Dennis! I spluttered a hasty thank you and goodbye to the glaucous-winged gull and splayed my wings for liftoff, destination CenturyLink, where I'd left one half of my murder outside a stadium stuffed with carnivorous mofos, as well as the animal responsible for the most fatalities in the whole of Africa. Just then, the ones I was waiting for arrived. The dark-eyed junco got there first, landing on a nearby hawthorn branch. It hopped, catching its breath. The glaucous-winged gull assuredly took to the air and gave me a quick glance that, I swear, seemed as if he knew a secret that he was having trouble keeping. I quickly called out to Aura to get news of my bloodhound partner, explaining exactly where I'd left him. A ruby-crowned kinglet beamed himself down from a higher branch and offered to see to it himself. I agreed somewhat reluctantly, watching him dart and vanish. Why was everyone suddenly being so helpful to the ostracized hybrid crow? A small eruption of soil burst from the grass as a creature like a tiny Komatsu bulldozer with a penile nose and a hamster butt emerged. It had mofo-like hands in the thin pink hue of a newly hatched bird, a mole. Or as Big Jim categorized them, yard-demolishing fuck trolls. Shortly after, an opossum wobbled into view at the base of the hawthorn, eggshell white, prehensile tail coiling behind him. I stared at a dark-eyed junco, a plump, black-headed bird, waiting for an explanation. The junco was full of sassafras. I could just tell by the way he bounced around, twitchy and convulsive. He made a deliberate smacking tick-tick-tick sound, one I suspected he also used to warn predators away from his nest. "Are you here to tell me about the one who opens doors?" I asked the Junco. He cocked his head an infuriating number of times. "Yep, yep, yep." "And why are they here?" I asked, gesturing to the blinking mole and the pasty-faced opossum. "Same reason he's here," said the opossum, yawning to expose a row of crooked needle teeth. "The one searched for sent word about you. You're the half-and-half bird with a porpoise." "Purpose, you common conehead," cheeped the Junco. The opossum ignored him. "You're the one who keeps. We're here to answer whatever you need answering. Help wherever we can." A swell of pride rose in me. When had anyone ever seen a mole, an opossum, and a Junco meet up, apart from in an unsavory joke? I was beginning to think that there was some sort of actual camaraderie between furred and feathered that I had overlooked before. A sort of basic respect, a communal back-scratching. The idea excited me. He added, "Also, some crows told us if we didn't come, they'd pluck out our eyes." I chose to ignore the additional intel. The mole shuffled around the patch of grass, sifting the soil with those pink hands. I wished they were a little larger so they could be of use.
"What are you half and half of?" he asked, dick nose waving in the air.
The mole was funny with his little mofo fingers. I had an undeniable urge to put a top hat on him. "I'm just who I am," I told him with some urgency. "Dennis, tell me what you know." The mole and the Junco started at the same time, interrupting one another. "I'll go first," said the Junco, head darting.
"No, me," said the mole, shuffling in place.
"One at a time," I said, looking up to the sky for signs of the ruby-crowned kinglet. "Opossum, you go first." The dark-eyed Junco muttered rapid-fire expletives. I'd already picked my favorite of the three. I'm not sure why everyone hates opossums so much. They may look like someone shaved the buttocks of a poodle and taught it to talk through its asshole, but they are generally pretty likable critters. "Hiss!" came the hideous warning the opossum spat at the Junco. It was pretty unlikable. "Okay, half and half bird, I'll tell you what my cousin told me. He saw the one who opens doors all right. You see, my cousin got in through the cat opening and was shuffling around this house where they had sweet black and white rounds in plastic. Oreos. We should discuss their exact whereabouts at a later date. Tell me what he saw." "My cousin heard the door shake. Then he saw the silver handle turning and he panicked and died." The Junco spit out more unintelligible insults in a disbelieving manner. "He died figuratively?" I tried to clarify. "No, like how I die when there's danger. I can just drop dead, like this." He passed away in front of us, tongue hanging out. I'd seen a buttload of death lately, and this was very convincing. "What did the one who opens doors look like?" I pressed him. The opossum resurrected himself. "He can't say for sure due to being dead and everything, but he sounded like this." He made a kind of indeterminate whooshing noise. "And he said he smelled like old smells, like old grass and leaves and things. Like hay, kind of. And also old stuff." "You idiots!" yelled the Junco. "He didn't even see him! What use are you, you damned sea anemone?" Everyone gasped. Obviously the Junco was a little unstable, but this was some serious line crossing. Calling someone a sea anemone was harsh. Sea anemone are the mob bosses of the ocean, venom harpooning their enemies and striking sticky deals with shifty types when it suits. Also, their mouths happen to be their anuses. The mole, the opossum, and I rose above the name-calling. "What about you, mole? What do you know about the one who opens doors?" The mole sat up and rubbed his pink fingers together. A monocle. He definitely needed a monocle. He talked slowly, as if his words were stuck in soil.
"I'll tell you all's I know. See, this was a while ago, see? 'Cause we dark soil moles have been doing our great migration, see? Anyways, I'd tunneled my way through the soil, had a few worms to keep my energy up, and 'cause my wife says I have to keep regular, too, sometimes I get gas."
"Make your point, you hagfish!" screeched the Junco. The opossum bared its needles again, and I actually saw the mole's eyeballs. The Junco was really riling everyone up. You don't hurl a hagfish comparison around willy-nilly.
No one wants to be associated with a blind, toothless tube that gets its jollies entering any orifice of a corpse to consume it inside out while producing up to 17 pints of mucus. Hey, calm down right now, Junko. I made it clear I didn't have time to waste. I had a dentist to return to, and the longer I was away from him, the harder it was to breathe. What did you see, Mole?
Well, my eyesight's a bit shit, but yeah. Yeah, I saw that he was very, very tall, and he moved in sweepy, sweeping motions. And my thinking was that if I didn't get back to my wife, she'd start whacking me again, so I dove back into the other world.
The other world. Onita had spoken of it. What's the other world? I asked, instantly receiving horrified looks from the unlikely trio.
The other world, you know. Web, said the mole, under the soil. Yous can't go there, but you must have heard about it.
When I didn't respond, his nose twitched fiercely, his hands raking the soil around him.
It's sort of like lots and lots of talking and good information. My wife always says,
Shut up, you mushroom tip! Screamed the Junko. This was an epic interspecies insult, because not only is that mofo slang for the head of a Johnson, but also the part of the mushroom above ground, the part sold at Albertsons and sitting on your pizza, is actually its sexual organ. The sexual escapades of fungi are a multifarious rabbit hole that, thankfully, I had too much on my plate to ponder. The Junko then spoke again with reverence in his tart voice for the first time.
The other world is the underground, where the truths come from. The intricate snaking of magical message pathways, a labyrinth of fungal threads that share knowings, teach us the ways. It is the communication hotbed of the underlings. It's made up of the real part of the forest, the roots, magical mycelium, red and yellow mineral horizons. It's the foundation of the forest, the very beginning. That's where trees really talk, where they share their legacy through the elements, whispering through water, negotiating in nitrogen, prophesying in phosphorus.
I'm sort of filling in parts here. It's very hard to simplify and translate.
Sage, mystic maple, their wise carbon counsel is available to those who listen to the stillness. The truths of our world are sourced directly from the other world. It is known as Web. And it's all run, well, mostly everything on Earth that we depend on is run by the mother trees. You know about them at least, right?
I shook my head.
Oh, flaming filberts! The mother trees are the matriarchs, the connectors of the forest, the leaders of the other world. We feathereds honor them with seed offerings. Web is denser and richer than Aura and Echo put together. Surely you know some of this? This is hatchling stuff!
The mole suddenly seemed a bit euphoric.
Under the soil is like magical. And that's how the trees truly talk. None of the above-ground whisperings that take so much of their energy. It's not their real language, see? That's why, if they're talking to you, you's better be listening, because they are making a mighty fine effort.
He rubbed those delicious fingers together. I knew Aura and Echo, but Web? What other entire worlds within the planet I've inhabited don't I know anything about? My corvid brain was spinning. What did it look like? The one who opens doors, I asked.
Probably grayish-black in color, maybe with a hint of green. There might have been some moss on him, maybe. I'm not sure. I could definitely swear that I maybe, possibly saw some moss, said the mole.
The wind-up toy of a Junko had it, spasming into some sort of meltdown on the branch of a hawthorn.
You fig-brained morons!
Stop, I cawed. While you are bickering, there are animals that don't belong in this city. Gorilla, hippo, elephant, running amok. Someone let them out of their enclosures. Someone who can open doors. And I intend to find that someone. So tell me what you know now.
Yep.
The Junko resumed its nervous hopping.
It came down this way and I followed it. It can crawl and climb and goes wherever it wants to.
Feathered?
No,
Fur?
Some.
Scales?
I think sort of. Kind of like a coconut?
Yep.
It was clear that Mensa wouldn't be calling for these three anytime soon, Mofo extinction notwithstanding. The Junko continued.
It had red hair and wore a wrap.
What he actually said translates as wrap around the torso, or in other words, a shirt. The world tilted. What did you just say? I asked.
Red hair, shirt.
You saw a mofo? My heart was a horse galloping across the plains. The Junko didn't understand. It walked on two legs. It was a hollow?
Adrenaline burned a hole in my chest.
Yes! The one who opens doors is a hollow. Last I saw, he was heading to the zoo.
Small fact for you here, the rough translation of zoo in bird Twitter is creature quilt, because that's what it looks like from above, a blanket made up of species-separated enclosures. The Junko continued.
You should have let me speak first. I already put out a call to Aura, and I heard back from birds around the Finney Ridge area. The one who opens doors is there!
Hope roared its luminous flames to life in my breast. With my brainy mofo reasoning, I'd figured the one who opens doors was responsible for letting out the zoo animals in the Finney Ridge neighborhood, since I'd first heard his name there on Aura, and it made perfect sense that he was still in the area. But oh, to hear that he was a mofo! I had never given up hope, and it had paid off. There was one mofo out there, which meant there were more mofos, which meant that everything was going to be okay. It was time to get to the zoo and find a way to make him my ally. I was the one who keeps. A bewildering nickname, but a special nickname for me nonetheless. I put out another call to Aura, projecting passionately over the hawthorns, the park's sprawling nest of bramble and knotweed, reaching across the Seattle skyline with my voice. I needed to know if anyone had heard from my bow-legged partner and the little ruby-crowned kinglet who'd gone after him. How stupid of me to send such a tiny bird. What was a ruby-crowned kinglet going to do in the face of a hippo? I made my nictitating membranes shut out the world momentarily, but they couldn't shut out the vision of a flooded stadium teeming with sick mofos. Twitter erupted as nuthatches and American goldfinches and even house wrens, who are known to stab other birds in the head for very minor infractions, called out, spreading the word. But I couldn't wait, because my heart was now on fire, and I shot into the air like a Brahmos missile, higher and higher and higher, until the tree crowns were thumbtacks and the freeways were gray strings. I shouldn't have left Dennis alone. I should have been taking care of him. I scanned, looking for the fawn hue of a bloodhound, flapping like a lunatic towards CenturyLink Field, but I couldn't stop the horrible images that flooded my mind. Dennis sitting alone by the blue trash can with the Seahawks emblem. And then, enraged because a squirrel has raced up and flashed his junk, Dennis takes off after the little pervert, knocking over the trash can and disappearing, getting swallowed whole by the new wilderness we live in. A world where sharp things, brambles, teeth and broken glass rule supreme. I thought of the rotting crush of sick mofos with snapping jaws and the size of the hippo, thousands of pounds of territorial killing machine with tusk weapons for teeth, and I just couldn't bear it. I knew I was about to have a heart attack and tumble from the sky. Dots of movement stirring below. Deer. A flash streaked across an empty road, a cat perhaps. Then a brown spot caught my eye. Yes, fawn, the tawny color of a Dennis. I started my descent, allowing gravity to guide me down, down, and as I neared, my throat closed up. The brown lump was on its side next to an oval pool of red. No. I dropped faster than ever before until I could make out the dog shape. The damage done to canine legs, the torn skin, tufts of fur catching a ride on the wind. Then I was hovering above with stone insides, sucking in breath and saying, I'm sorry, to the brown dog I didn't know. The brown dog that wasn't a Dennis. Relief flooded me. It felt like singing along to Bon Jovi with Big Jim, or when you think the Pringles are all gone, but you stick your head inside the canister and there are more hiding at the bottom. Not Dennis! Not Dennis! I flapped steadily, moving my head side to side to get a better look at the body. It was a Rhodesian Ridgeback, a breed characterized by the stiff mohawk that runs the opposite way down its back, and it had lost its last fight. And then I felt like screaming and cursing whatever had done this to such a magnificent dog. A dog carefully bred and selected and loved by mofos. This was why I had to free the domestics, to rally them together, because we were losing our civilized fauna, the ones who knew about loyalty, purpose, and mofo magnificence. I quickly lifted to a sweet gum tree to recover and to make sure I wasn't in reach of whatever had taken out a dog that was bred to hunt lions. If this formidable specimen hadn't made it, what chance did Dennis have? My inner pilot light started to snuff out. I needed my murder more than ever. Where was my Dennis? If he ended up like this shell of a Rhodesian Ridgeback, there would be no one to blame but me. A skittish cat, a white and marmalade firework, shot across the road, disappearing into the bushes. And then, from the shadow of a cluster of American hornbeam trees, Dennis appeared with a bird on his head. He lumbered forward with his loose skin and those silly, silly paws and his big, beating heart, and I cried out in joy. That burl-nosed butt pumpkin was smiling at me. I couldn't remember the last time I felt so ecstatic, light as a damned flight feather. The ruby-crowned kinglet bobbed along on his head, and as they neared, carefully avoiding the Rhodesian Ridgeback, may he rest in peace, I realized what Dennis was carrying in his slobbering, flopping-jowled mouth. He had a goddamned bag of Cheetos, that crazy hound. I called out to him in English, using the back of my throat and doing my very best Big Jim.
Good boy, Dennis. Fuck.
And when they got close enough, I pulled his tail and fluttered around him. He dropped the Cheetos and play bit at the air, lunging at me with his goofball smile. Good old Dennis. What a champ. I blabbed at him, telling him that a mofo was alive and well, and that we were going to find him, and the world would make sense again. Heavens to the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, it felt good to be alive. I thanked the kinglet and told him that, though I appreciated his efforts, the position of riding Dennis had already been filled. He seemed to understand. He told me that Dennis had already almost found me at the park on his own. He figured he'd used his amazing nose, but had veered off on another scent trail, which turned out to be for the miraculous bag of Cheetos. Together, we trekked our way back to the park, where I doled out the Cheetos, splitting them among Dennis, the mole, the opossum, the junco, and myself, which meant that everyone else got 4, while Dennis and I got 12, because, as I've said before, my counting is so terrible. So, with light hearts and bellies full of day-glow orange magic, we set off on a quest to find a mofo who looked like a coconut that could open doors. Chapter 14. ST. Just outside Dr. Jose Rizal Park, Seattle, Washington, USA. Dennis and I set off, leaving the opossum, the mole, and the junco to argue about which of them benefited most from the recent resurgence of the honeybee population. The opossum licked his lips while describing the thrill of tucking into a freshly broken open hive, while the junco screamed about the sanctity of pollination and how the bees bring luck to the ones they choose. The mole yelled mostly unintelligible things. Blinded by their egotistic squabble, they managed to miss the very thing they had in common: mutual reverence for the bees of this world. So it was back to me and Dennis again, our little murder, just how it should have been. We headed north, the trees shivering their leaves in approval, breathing relief into the wind. Their desperate pointing had stopped. A couple of blue-assed flies flitted around Dennis's scab. I called them opportunistic troglodytes, and then called them lunch. Flying low with contented flaps in the shade of Dennis's shadow, I thought about the other worlds I'd learned of. Worlds that had always been here, but that I'd never seen or even heard about from the confines of our little house in Ravenna. Maybe it was because the mofo world was so much louder. It drowned everything out with its clamor and fluorescent lights and bubbly pizzazz. And yet, I felt a tickling cognizance, dewdrops beating in my mind. Perhaps I'd always known, always been aware that there is more to be seen than what is in front of me. Perhaps I'd deliberately chosen not to acknowledge the story a flower tells or the particular vibration of rocks. When the mole spoke of the mother trees, I didn't question him because somewhere deep down, below feather and skin and bleached bone, I knew. As we made our plodding way towards Seattle's Central Zoo, I thought about the life I'd lived between four walls and wondered how different I was from the animals in the enclosures. I tuned in to Aura, listening to the back and forth of birds. There was much chatter over the missing eggs of a willow flycatcher. A band-tailed pigeon pined for its mate, and there were concerned murmurs over the unknown whereabouts of the one who spits. We filled our bellies and bladders so that my partner could douse what was left of our fine city in urine, and then we set off again. I rode Dennis, reluctantly leaving the loose, slippery, dark fur of his back, only to do recon. The area directly north of Dr. Jose Reisel Park was quiet. Quiet in that dangerous, pernicious way that invites you to relax and lose your vigilance. Midair, I spotted a gaggle of mofos flocking on top of an RV. Growling and braying, they obsessively drove their nails into the RV's rooftop. Many more of them, some burnt, one faceless, one wearing a flagpole in her neck, thronged the RV, rocking it from side to side, a vehicle so full that parts of mofos stuck out of its windows. Returning to Dennis and Terra Firma, I called for him to follow me with a whistle and a, "Come here, boy," and we carefully avoided them by passing through a neighborhood. The first house we approached had an etch-a-sketch doodle of tire tracks across its lawn. A leggy Japanese maple lay on its side, the casualty of the car's hasty retreat, its leaves curled at the edges as if it had been grasping at something just out of reach in its final moments. The driveway was littered with credit cards and crumpled cash notes. Big Jim used to tell me that money talks, but this stash was mighty silent. I suspect this is one of those mofo expressions meant to confuse, like when I wasted an entire afternoon searching the yard for an axe and a body because Big Jim said he'd buried the hatchet with his friend Mike. I picked up the shiniest quarter, then dropped it upon realizing how pointless cashing it would be given our new nomadic life. Old habits die hard. The neighboring home had a moss-shrouded roof and a mofo that caught us off guard. Dennis shot across the street and hid behind an abandoned table shielded by a sign that said, "Lemonade, $1," in chubby chalk writing. I rose above, scanning for more craned necks. Finding none in the immediate vicinity, I lowered enough to get a better look. The mofo's neck was bent unnaturally at an inquisitive 90-degree angle, and he had four gashes deep in his forehead. He wore a once-white Cougars shirt, now covered in bright paint splashes and filth, the red predator cat emblem barely visible. The mofo had worn a ring of mud into the overgrown front lawn. Who knows how many times he had trudged this constricted circle. The leash, attached to an enormous dog collar around his dislocated neck, taut and tethered to a wooden stake in the ground. Several feet away, someone had erected a small white cross festooned with photographs of a young athletic mofo. Candles and letters acneed with purple hearts crowded the stem of the cross. Another sign, Sharpie on plywood, sat near the tethered mofo. It read, "Leave my son alone. Family." I was at once haunted by the image of the minivan on the freeway of death, the decal stickers on its back windshield showing its mofo occupants in superhero garb, alongside another white outline with a smile and a floppy tongue, the family dog. A domestic. I fluttered over the mofo and landed on the windowsill. Poking my head through the glassless window frame, I was walloped with an olfactory offense. It was worse than the rotting, neglected garbage that now speckled Seattle, worse than Nargatha's homemade patchouli oil deodorant or Big Jim's post-camping boxers. The dog, a Boston Terrier, lay quietly in the living room, a bone-shaped chew toy by his side. Under his paws was a small collection of T-shirts that probably held the smell of his mofos. The terrier had been partially eaten, possibly by the ones who raised him, bitten by the mouths that taught him to sit and how to be in the world. I was angry. fueled with rage that some wild monster with no regard for the laws of life got to thrive and build a lair in King Street Station, and this family member, no doubt a loyal and loving companion, was here, feeding maggots. I shot back to Dennis as if filled with diesel and sriracha. I was fucking going to do anything I had to do to get the one who opens doors on my side. Before we moved on, I checked the next couple of houses for signs of mofos and domestic life. If there were pets in any of the homes, I couldn't see them. I was met with closed windows, glass intact, which threw me, and doors I couldn't open. We passed a house that had at some point caught fire and was now charred, black and white as an old photo. The only sign of remaining life was the crispy pages feebly attempting flight from books, their spines black and broken. Down the street, perhaps inspired by the blaze, someone had made a bonfire and stacked it high with logs and deceased cattle. Closer inspection revealed that only one body was a cow. The rest were mofos, parts and pieces still twitching and writhing in spite of everything. These were the things that were hardest on the eyes, even tougher to digest than apple seeds. I guess when the spirit of a species leaves us, it doesn't go easily. I ushered us past and didn't comment on the horror all around, concerned for Dennis's mental well-being. I reminded him that we were on our way to meet the one who opens doors, a mofo like our Big Jim with a clever brain and kind fingers. I had to keep Dennis afloat, to stave off what Oneida had called the black tide. So I told him jokes about promiscuous blondes and even one I'd made up, which I was exceedingly proud of. "Hey, Dennis, what did the koalas say when their keepers shaved them?" Dennis awaited my response with bated dog breath. "Eucalyptus. Get it? Eucalyptus." I'm pretty sure he snorted in delight. I reminded him that it was a shit-turd original. Dennis and I passed more housing, even one that was covered in crudely tacked sheet metal with no visible windows or doors. Covering your crib in sheet metal is a pretty intense back-off. But amidst the darkness of that zoo-bound march, there were undeniable sunspells. Close to that metal house, in a stand of magnolias that had erupted into a confection of pink and white, came a chittering. Three golden lion tamarins shot across the arms of the magnolia trees on a medley of cheeps. Their funny little gray, "what's going on" faces and flat-ironed noses framed by a mane of flame-orange hair. They hopped and scurried along the branches, sending pink and white blossoms snowing onto Dennis, who came to life, barking at them, padded paws slapping against the tree trunk. His droopy eyes lit into a warm amber, and his bulky body gained a little more bounce. I watched them torment my partner playfully, enjoying it all. Tree, dog, and monkey, all taunting one another in a way we were now desperately craving. Vibrancy. Zest. Life. The high-pitched cheeping suddenly stopped, and the tamarins, perhaps experiencing life at a different pace from us, took off, tangerine tails trailing behind them. The third tamarin stopped mid-branch, turned, and nailed me squarely with milk-dud eyes. Nothing was said. Just a silent exchange that didn't need translation. We recognized the great change that had occurred, and I knew we were both unsure of what it would bring. We saw one another. The tamarin turned to catch up with the others and exposed two tiny orange nuggets fused to her back. New life. It gave me a jolt, a Red Bull rush to the heart. It was so refreshing. I was only mildly offended that it was the tamarins who had put the pep back in Dennis's step. We ushered each other along, and I reminded Dennis about the big thing Big Jim did, the thing we can never forget. He listened wordlessly and then stopped in his tracks. With a whimper, he stared at an enormous structure covered in blue tarp that hadn't looked like much from the sky. The tarp billowed and rippled where something underneath moved. A forklift sat nearby. I fluttered to the top of the forklift and contemplated whether it was worth going near the breathing tarp. Oh yeah, wait. Crow! A fly around the blue tarp mountain revealed that it was as tall as a magnolia. I selected a piece of the tarp that wasn't moving. It felt rough, crinkling in my beak. The plastic blue material was heavy, and I flapped and flapped, yanking hard until I felt the tarp beneath me start to give way. I opened my beak and rose above. The heavy tarp fell on itself, causing a great section of it to slip off the mountain and reveal what had been sequestered underneath. Dog crates. A mountain of dog crates. And stuffed inside each one was a mofo. A mofo in a designer suit, one in yoga attire, another swaddled in some sort of homemade armor. Mofos of all types and colors and degrees of degradation. The tarp's movement animated them, and they responded in snarls and hisses. Attached to one of the crates was a sign. I swooped closer to read, "Do not remove tarp. Transport to Area 7. At this point, I was wholly absorbed in reading the black letters, and fixated focus in this new world spells certain doom. I slipped up. I lost my vigilance. Fingers, dexterous and long, snatched my left wing, curling around it. I shrieked, a panicking flurry of midnight feathers. Dennis burst into a barking frenzy, his booms getting louder as he neared. The fingers pulled me in, crate bars getting closer and closer. I was heading into a noxious smell, into yellow teeth with lumps of rotting tissue between them. No! I contorted my body with a sharp twist and shot backward, freeing myself of the dirty digits. The mofo who owned the hand stared at me from its crate, a caged prisoner who was feral and free from the bars of sanity. It was a female mofo, and at once I knew her, because I don't forget faces, even ones that look like they've exfoliated in the garbage disposal. She was a local news anchor who had brought us stories of heroes and horrors. She still had her TV red dress on. Big Jim would be falling over backward if he were here. He loved this local news anchor, and I approved. She had kind eyes and seemed to be able to afford more clothing than a lot of Big Jim's TV crushes. Dennis stopped barking, but trotted nervously at the base of the crates, licking his lips. He didn't like any of this, not the threat on his partner or the unstable mofos. He'd also never been great with crates. I thought it best to keep moving. It's harder to catch a thing in motion. The sun played hide-and-seek behind clouds, bathing us in light when it saw fit, mimicking our unsettled mood. Our journey north became more and more pressing with every paw print. Dread sat undigested in our bellies like day-old ramen. We stuck to open roads, walking toward a horizon of hope. Hope that balanced on the mysterious, faceless frame of the one who opens doors. From the air, I made out a mass of mofos ahead, hundreds and hundreds of bent bodies. These ones were also swarming, an army of craned necks and shedding skin, all looking up. It was horrible to see them from the sky, a frenzied horde with blood-red eyes staring up at you. But it turns out they weren't staring at me. I descended to find them teeming around a lamppost, stretching their rotting limbs and coughing out their intention in thick, mucousy bellows. Their leathery fingers slipped off the post, and those who lunged up the pole smacked it hard with their bodies, sliding back down to be swallowed by the crushing rabble below. I flapped closer to the post to find it was slick with some sort of grease. And at the top of the lamppost, dangling from a wire fastidiously twisted around the lamp head, was a cell phone. I flashed back to Big Jim after his eyeball fell out, how he'd chased me down like a possessed fiend when I had his cell phone. I flashed on the napkin scrawled on by the mofo lady trapped in the oyster house. "Tell Peter John Stein I love him. Tell him, but do not use your phone." The mofos, searching red eyes and stooped skeletons, were hunting for phones. This was bait, a trap set as a way to lure them in or away from something. I whistled for Dennis, and we snuck around an abandoned apartment building to avoid the hysterical mass. We made it to Fremont, where I insisted on a short detour, zipping through the smashed glass doors of a place called the Flying Apron. Dennis and I, being from a family of devoutly religious eaters, committed not only to socially designated meals, but also less traditional mealtimes like, "It's already Taco Tuesday in Sweden," "Tater Tots are mood-enhancing potato pillows," and Cheese is the cure for boredom. The thing about family traditions is that they are sacred and should be upheld at all costs. The Flying Apron, singing its gluten-free vegan status in swirly writing, turned out to be a quaint little bakery. Or it probably was before its tables and chairs had all been smashed to splinters. Wall hangings lay in shards on the ground. Its exposed kitchen was blanketed in winter white, doused in some sort of flour. It was empty of mobile occupants, but for one apron-clad mofo who was too busy smashing what was left of its cranium onto what was left of a hanging mirror to notice us. I carefully selected a treat from the counter of surprisingly intact goodies with pink identifying labels. I got to work on a vegan chocolate chip cookie made with garbanzo flour, plucking out the chips with concerted effort. It had aged nicely and had the complex consistency of compacted sand. Dennis helped himself to three apricot thumbnails, a blueberry oat scone, a rock-hard portobello mushroom sandwich, half a cardamom chai cake, three green tea macaroons, a cinnamon roll, and a pumpkin ginger muffin. Dennis is effectively waste management on legs. I'd always had a glorious daydream of signing him up for Nathan's hot dog eating contest on Coney Island. I'd show up as his manager, you see, decked out in a pinstriped suit and hat, and George Shea would pat me on the back and come up with some witty name for Dennis. The rapacious rapscallion of Ravenna, the peckish puppy with peristaltic pancreas power. Then I'd carefully go about placing some serious cash with the bookies. My strategy was not to hang around anywhere for too long, so once we'd ransacked the Flying Apron's baked goods counter, we fired up our jets, made like geese, and got the flock out of there. Before we knew it, with our hearts in our throats and sustainable, gluten, dairy, egg, soy, corn-free, alternatively sweetened treats in our stomachs, we'd made it to the Woodland Park Zoo. The sun was settling into the horizon, and the sky suddenly darkened with the black bodies of crows. College crows were flying northeast, heading to their stupid night roost to snuggle up together like a bunch of poop terrorists. They chatted about plans for the evening, some calling out to me. I ignored them. They were not my business. As I sat atop my trusty hound, preparing to cross the abandoned west parking lot of the zoo, we spotted a red GMC Yukon that sat unnaturally upright, trunk on the ground, hood in the air, against the bole of the European white birch it had collided with. Two titan trunks had done battle. It was the birch that had survived, but it had suffered, parts of its bark peeling like sunburned skin, and I bowed my head in respect, thinking of the mother trees. "I'm sorry this happened to you," I told the tree, feeling a prick of self-consciousness. Everywhere I looked was more vibrant, more alive, like I was seeing it in 4D, in the new knowledge I'd acquired. Life is not the same once you've learned just how deeply a tree can feel. The parking lot meters had their glass screens smashed out. One lay in trampled pieces, dried blood smearing the mashed metallic keypad. Preparing to follow the ramp that led down to the entrance of the Woodland Park Zoo, a sharp breeze ruffled my feathers.
"Alive,"
I heard the word, a thin whistle that whipped through the air on the limpid wings of a dragonfly. Dennis stopped. I recalled the words of a mole with icing pink hands.
"Under the soil is like magical, and that's how the trees truly talk. None of the above-ground whisperings that take so much of their energy. It's not their real language, see? That's why, if they're talking to you, yous better be listening, because they are making a mighty fine effort."
I had heard the effort. Dennis and I both turned to face the house that summoned us. It peered from behind an enormous Douglas fir, timid and tiny, with a teal and white paint job. An exposed brick chimney rose like a surrender flag. And then I noticed one of the fir's colossal branches was pointed toward the teal house's front door. A shiver scurried up Dennis's back, jumping species to scamper up my legs and under my down.
"Alive,"
the silvery voice sounded out again. "Yep, I got it," I squawked to no one in particular, suddenly feeling like a blue-footed booby. I was really living outside my comfort zone these days. Then A thought struck me. Alive. Could it be? Could there be a healthy mofo inside this home? My whole body began to shake with excitement, my beak chattering uncontrollably. Dennis ambled up the short driveway and stone steps to a teal front door. The Douglas fir loomed above, a silent guardian. The door remained closed, an impenetrable obstacle, essentially Fort Knox to me, Dennis, and the Douglas fir, the ones without opposable thumbs. I pecked fruitlessly at the door handle. "Hello?" I asked in English, appealing to the mofo within. "Hello?" Hopping onto a doormat that seemed to be a liar with its message of welcome, I scratched desperately against the green wood with my feet and beak. A bated silence. Then, an outbreak of barking filled the air. I shot up, flapping like a loon to the nearest window. My face smacked into the glass, pain shooting up my beak, embarrassment burning my veins. I shook my head, thinking I should be immediately vindicated for this classic bird faux pas because there hadn't been glass anywhere else in this damn city. Dennis let out one deep and sonorous woof, a greeting. The yapping coming from inside became panicked and frenzied. The window was painted with a film of dust and the dotted imprint of my snooter, but I could see in all right. I could see the quaint living room with the family portrait and the sooty fireplace. How the powdery hardwood was littered with empty wrappers. I saw dust motes dancing through the light beams coming through various windows, all intact. And the source of the yapping became clear. In among the king's Hawaiian bread bags, hollow dog chow sacks, punctured peanut butter jars, shredded cake mix boxes, a graveyard of graham crackers, Chips Ahoy, Lucky Charms, quinoa, and a landmine of raw pasta lumps and turds, was a Pomeranian. Signs told me there had been no healthy mofo here for a long time, but still, there was a survivor. She yipped at the window, a chaotic SOS song in the key of fear. Her button eyes were brimming and shiny. I marveled. This was a creature who deserved life. She had managed to avoid getting attacked by her changed mofos. She'd avoided getting mauled by wild creatures despite practically living at the zoo. She had been imprisoned for who knows how long, and she'd lived on the American diet and persevered. I felt a sense of awe for this Pomeranian, historically a lapdog for German royal mofos, desperately loved and respected by her own mofos, as evidenced by the custom-framed 11x16 portrait of her in a Christmas sweater and her tartan monogrammed bed. Her name was Cinnamon, and I was going to break her out of there. The mofos wouldn't have stood for her imprisonment and suffering. They'd have called the ASPCA or NASA or AARP, and they'd smash the teal door in and save her life like the heroes they were born to be. She was someone's Dennis, and I was going to give her one more chance at survival.
"Cinnamon, sit,"
I told her through the glass. She cocked her head. Seized by palpable jubilance at words she knew and utter bewilderment at getting dragooned by a bird. My heart soared as she parked her tiny furry butt next to a fossilized Fig Newton. It worked! In that moment, I felt more powerful than Scarface and his little friend. I rapped my beak on the glass one more time, cursing its impenetrable force field of a surface, the bane of all birds. I might not have been able to open windows, but I was lucky because Big Jim taught me about the dangers of them back when I was just a nestling, a tiny toothpick-boned goblin. The first time I bumped my beak into the glass, he scooped me up in his sausage fingers, told me not to be embarrassed, and showed me YouTube evidence of mofos slamming into glass doors.
"It's the reflection of trees and plants that's confusing, ST," Big Jim said. "One time I plowed into a Walmart door and spilled hot coffee all over my balls."
Then, just for me, he marked each window of our house with a hastily bought gas station bumper sticker, like "Baby on Board," "Well-behaved women rarely make history," and "I love my Belgian Malinois." I gave Cinnamon a nod through the glass. I dropped from the window ledge, shuffled back over to the front door, gave it a mighty kick, and let out a lengthy "Caw!" to cover up the self-inflicted foot pain. Dennis rolled his eyes and whined. "Nope,
We weren't getting in.
We're coming back for you, I promise, I told her in croaky clicks.
As we reluctantly turned to leave, she began to whine, paws padding away inside her prison. The last glimpse I stole was heartbreaking. She was a tornado of fluff, spinning round and round. The tiny survivor didn't want us to leave, but I didn't know how long it was possible to stay alive, even as a real tough fluff survivor type, in a sealed cemetery of empty wrappers and excrement. We had to hurry. I went airborne, and Dennis thundered across Finney Avenue, lit with purpose. We would find the one who opens doors, and this little teal and white house would be our very first stop. Our first freeing. And we would do the mofo thing and free the others. We'd find all the surviving Dennises and give them a chance at living. We crossed the street and stood under the bold white letters that said Woodland Park Zoo. You can imagine how elated I was to discover that they'd placed cutouts of frolicking penguins all over their sign. Fucking newspaper-colored, ice-balled dick goblins. Yeah, that's who you want as your brand ambassador. It was a deeply ominous portent, right in front of the entrance. I could only hope that there would be some balance, that inside we'd find the one who opens doors, and they'd be in sync with our vision, our plan to set the domestics free, to give them a chance to thrive and keep the legacy of the mofos alive. The problem was, I didn't know what was on the other side of the zoo's turnstile gate. Dennis barfed, and I wasn't sure whether it was a comment on our nerve-wracking predicament or the portobello mushroom sandwich staging its final protest. Chapter 15. Just above the root structure of a 200-year-old spruce tree. Translation by Estellers J.
What if I were to offer you an extraordinary gift? What if it were to change the way your eyes took in the world? Would you accept? Would you keep it or toss it aside? You see, I know you. I've been watching you your whole exquisite life. I am Mother Tree, part of something greater than my one. We of ancient forest and all of us are connected through swirling root, here and there, so tightly we interweave that when one of us dies, the other must die too. Our stand is one, braving licks of lightning and the sticky scarlet appetites of insects. We warn neighboring crowns of drought and danger with our scent song and send quick silvery messages through web, fungal lattice. Like you, we sweat. We scream when thirsty. We bleed when sliced. And we remember. Listen. Our words through crackling roots and the echoing pulse of a mushroom's gossamer threads are not bound by time. And a secret for you. If one of us is felled and left as a bloody stump, we will send it our healing, quietly cheating death for 100 years. You don't know about these things, because until the gift, you haven't been listening. Your magnificent eyes have been down. Do you know how many years I am? Do you know that if you press your shell-like ear to my bark, you can join in my drinking? Did you know there are more lives in a palm full of soil than of your kind on this big, beautiful blue? Perhaps you still cannot see that I am fighting the greatest battle of my years. A bark beetle army has declared war on my body. It started like many beginnings, with a singular soldier who chose change. He burrowed into my skin. He summoned a militia, and I hammered back, unleashing gluey syrup onto the glossy armor of an infantry. And now, a complexity in the art of war, the army has brought reserve soldiers, this time with a fungus on their backs. Now the fungus will aid them, burrowing under my bark to sever my defense. Listen, life is worth a fight. Expectation must be shed like winter leaves. Even in death there is wondrous beauty, and death is not the end. I have given you a gift. Now you see me. You see the stippled scarring on my trunk where a woodpecker drilled into me for blood. You see Moss, my emerald, cushiony companion. Watch her survive. She was the very first of us on this big, beautiful blue. You see my children who stand at my feet. One day I will crumble and shatter to the forest floor, where my bones will feed 1,000 hungry mouths, and my children will stretch for the sun. The one who hollows as well must return. Life is as beautiful as it is deadly. Fungi might be friend or foe. Breathe. Listen. Look. The forest is where all secrets are kept under lock and key, deep in soils dark and rich. The woods are where the truth lives, etched into the veins of leaves and the prismatic skin of a dewdrop. If you are alive, whether of blood or bark, you will be struck by pain, love, longing, fear, anger, and the particular ache of sadness. There will be joys that quiver your leaves and betrayals that will sever your roots, poisoning the water you pull. These are the varying notes in the music of living. Look up. To close your eyes is to stagnate, to rot and stop the song. My gift to you is to know that we are here, all around you, talking to one another and dreaming of your success. Sorcery is everywhere, in the silver stroll of a slug and lighting up the very veins of you. Open those beautiful eyes to a world who is a mosaic of magic. She is just waiting for you to notice.